Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and I'd like to welcome to the program today Samuel Fromarts. His new book is called In Search of the Perfect Loaf, A Home Baker's Odyssey. He joins us by telephone from somewhere near the nation's capital, I believe. Welcome to the program.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me. Actually, right in the nation's capital.
Wow. Okay, so this one's coming into us from within the Beltway.
Yes. Yeah. That's right.
This is a fascinating story. What a fun book. Tell our listeners how this happened. This is sort of the product of a disaster, wasn't it?
It was. I had been a home baker for about 15 years, and you know, my day job was a journalist. But I didn't want to write about my home baking exploits because it was what I used to kind of relax from the stress of daily journalism. And so I really kept it off the side. But what happened in late 2008, you know, after Lehman Brothers collapsed and the economy went into a deep freeze, I lost a lot of work and started sending emails around to friends about, you know, whether they had any possibilities. And one was an editor at a travel magazine, and asked if I had any ideas for stories they might use. And I said, well, I've always wanted to go to Paris to bake in a boulangerie. So lo and behold, you know, a couple weeks later, or actually about 3 weeks later, I was headed on a plane with empty seats, you know, going to Paris. So,
and the end of this journey turned into this fun book where you ended up going all kinds of places. You went to the West Coast. You went to Berlin. You became quite the traveler, chasing down these loaves of bread. Tell our listeners what kind of bread you were interested in.
Well, I was simply interested in well-made bread, and surprisingly, it's kind of, you know, really stellar bakeries that I think really you know, produce exceptional loaves, you know, are kind of few and far between, except, and here's the proviso, you know, in certain areas of the country where you'll get sort of a concentration of great bakers and great bakeries simply because the public supports them and they kind of build this critical mass. So I had been making sourdoughs for a long time, sourdough loaves, but wanted to find out, you know, look into more about the bakeries that were really influencing the direction of these breads, and for the most part, many of them were in around the Bay Area of California. So I ended up working with three bakers there. You know, my story of going to Berlin was really to explore whole grain breads, because in Germany, whole grain breads, you know, they aren't eaten because they have a sticker, you know, on the package with how much fiber they have, or because the government tells you to eat whole grains. People eat them because it's simply good bread. And so I worked in this really exceptional bakery in Berlin that ground its own flour and made these whole grain loaves, mostly rye. And then I ended up in the south of France simply because I was interested in this one baker who grew his own varieties of ancient wheat and milled them in a windmill, and then baked the loaves in a wood-fired oven for his hilltop village. So, mm-hmm. You know, so that was quite an extraordinary experience, too.
Samuel Fromarts joins us. His book is In Search of the Perfect Loaf, A Home Baker's Odyssey. Okay, you went to Paris first, and you went there, and you ate a lot of bread. And I didn't realize that there had been a problem with French bread where it had been in decline. And apparently this had been going on since about the 70s?
Correct, yeah. I mean, what happened was essentially bakers speeded up the baking process, you know, making the loaves much more quickly. And as a result, they kind of sacrificed quality, because the key to really a good loaf is a long fermentation. You know, and a long fermentation takes time. And as we know from a business perspective, time is money. So you want to, you know, if you want to maximize, you know, your profit, you knock out as many loaves as you can quickly. I mean, that's kind of what's the problem with most industrial versions of bread. But in Paris, in France as a whole, that became sort of the way that bakers were taught and the way they did things. And as a result, the public started voting with their feet, and bread consumption fell dramatically until the point in the 1980s when people were really concerned about whether this iconic food of France, you know, bread, would really be lost. And even one prominent writer was wondering whether the best baguettes would soon be made in Tokyo. Mm-hmm. And actually, currently, Japan does have really great bread makers, so, you know. And even today, I think in France, the really stellar kind of artisan bakers, you know, are still, you know, in the vast minority. And people in France will tell you that in some places of France, you know, you just can't find a decent boulangerie. And as a result, people just end up buying their bread at the supermarket. So it's kind of, you know, they were, at that time, I think in the early 80s, they were really facing this crisis of culture. But there was a resurgence of good bread in the 90s, and I think is still that process is going on today.
In Paris, you describe getting tips about who had the best baguettes, and you went around and you tried them all, and it sounded like you were almost getting kind of burned out. You'd eaten so much bread, and so there were so many good loaves. And then you heard about this baker who had some little kind of hole-in-the-wall place, and you went over there, and you discovered he had this set up in the basement.
Right. He had he was a really interesting guy, Frédéric Pichard, and he's in the 15th arrondissement of Paris. And it's a very residential neighborhood, and he simply bakes for the neighborhood. He's not the kind of baker who's on, you know, the top list of tourist destinations or that kind of thing. But he bakes bread from, he gets his flour from one farm in the north of France, and he grows a very special type of grain that's milled into flour. And then he does what is a really unusual process of fabricating this loaf, which involves just mixing the flour and water and a little salt and just letting it sit by, you know, alone for like 24 hours. And whatever natural yeast is on the flour itself starts to ferment that batch. And it's until that process is done that he then adds a little bit of baker's yeast to help the process along. And he kind of likens it to the process of making champagne, where you let the grapes naturally ferment with the yeast which are on the grape itself. And then it's only after letting that natural fermentation occur that you add wine yeasts that help, you know, the process of champagne along. So he kind of mimicked that process in his own bread making. So he was really trying to get the flavor of that particular wheat, and he felt this was the best way to do it.
When I read that section, thought about lambics and how they make those, where they open the top of the brew house and they let the wild yeast come in.
Right, exactly. So, you know, bread making, you know, historically was made with wild yeast. That's what sourdough is. It just captures wild yeast and bacteria, and that prompts the fermentation process. And there's always been this very close relationship between beer making and bread making. Precisely because they often use the same, you know, grains. I mean, barley, which is used in beer making, was made into, you know, bread at one time as well. So, you know, just knowing how to do that and using the benefits of a natural fermentation, you know, can really alter flavors, which is why beer makers use that process.
They probably made beer first, right, before bread?
That's correct. That's the conjecture. Mm-hmm. It can't really be settled with hard evidence, but I talked to archaeologists who study these ancient remains, you know, of charred grains and sites in the Fertile Crescent, which is basically now the war-torn areas of Iraq, you know, Syria and southern Turkey, obviously not in, engulfed in the war right now, but it's all part of that same region. The conjecture is that people knew how to make wine from fermenting fruit, which naturally ferments even if it's just hanging on the vine. But they turned to grains because fruit was seasonal, whereas grains could be stored. And they probably started to ferment those in a process not dissimilar from wine. And only later then started to cook, you know, those grains, those fermented grains into loaves. You know, we don't really know because there's no, you know, the evidence doesn't exist. But it's conjecture sort of based on pits that appear to be used for beer making, you know, that may date, you know, more than 9,000 years ago.
Samuel Fromarts joins us. His book is In Search of the Perfect Loaf, The Home Baker's Odyssey. And I learned a lot from this book. And one thing that I've always been fascinated with, well, at least since the first time I encountered it, is the whole idea of dough, that starter that people, you know, nurture and carry around. And you have a whole chapter about this. And I remember the first time I ever encountered it, I was in Vermont, and we were skiing, and we were in this unheated cabin up in the mountains. And there was a woman on the trip who had this sourdough starter with her, and I'd never heard of such a thing, and she would take it to bed with her to keep it warm. And I thought, what is this? And then she baked some bread, and I was like, now I get it.
Right, right. Well, I describe sourdough. It's really a medium to grow yeast and bacteria, and what they do is basically digest the carbohydrates in flour, and they belch out carbon dioxide gas, which makes a loaf rise, and they also belch out alcohol, which changes the flavor of the bread, making it slightly tangy, or even kind of getting the lactic acid notes that you would find in yogurt. So that's what, you know, that's what sourdough does. But to nurture it, you're really farming microscopic animals, you know, so you become a farmer, and she probably took it to bed with her because she wanted to keep her animals nice and warm, you know, so that they would reproduce and continue to consume the carbohydrates in the flour and belch out these gases, and then, you know, once added to a bigger piece of dough, it would make that dough rise. So, you know, sourdough has a lot of really wonderful qualities, I think, that we've largely forgotten, you know, one being the taste, which can range from a very sharp acidic taste, as with more like sort of so-called San Francisco sourdoughs, to much more mild loaves, mild tasting, kind of, you know, sort of milky tasting loaves that you would find, you know, in France or Germany. And the other thing, the acids that it produces, because these are all, those flavor compounds are all acidic, they really extend the shelf life of a loaf. So like a whole grain rye will keep on your counter, you know, for you can eat it for a week without it going stale or moldy or anything else. So, you know, it's the perfect, also kind of a perfect food for the pre-modern era, where people cooked that they wanted, you know, something around that they could eat for a while. They wouldn't have to cook every day. And so descriptions exist of these very large, you know, up to 10-pound loaves, which you would eat, you know, over the course of a week or two.
Wow.
You know, and those don't really exist anymore either.
The staff of life.
Yeah. Yeah. And it sort of argues against this idea of freshness, at least with sourdough. You know, the flavor actually, it's kind of like wine. It kind of improves after about 3 days. The flavor is really mellow, and the flavor of the loaf literally evolves. And so, you know, we have this idea that everything should be really fresh, you know, and it's just, in cases of fermented foods, I think it's kind of a misunderstanding
It's like all food should be Beaujolais Nouveau.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
Samuel Fromarts joins us. Another thing I learned, I'm sure we have listeners out there right now who are saying, oh, this is all great, but I can't eat gluten. You know, I think this is really interesting, but I can't eat a baguette. I can't do this. I can't do that. And you make several points in the book about the diversity of wheat and how there might be a connection between the loss of diversity of different types of wheat and people who have problems with gluten.
Yeah, I mean, that's something that researchers are looking into. I mean, the jury's still out on that question, but it's a compelling one simply because, you know, in the pre-modern era, farmers would grow a diverse set of grains. You know, they would grow wheat, they would grow rye, they would grow barley, you know, they would grow oats. And the reason they grew all these crops is because they were hedging their bets. You know, if one failed, another might make it. And when, you know, grain is your main source of calories, you don't want the crop to fail.
Mm.
So as a result, they wheat was not the default grain. You know, it was in many cases more rare than these other grains like rye and barley and spelts and even non-related foodstuffs like, you know, lentils or chickpeas, which were also made into their own, you know, kind of flatbreads.
Mm.
So my, you know, what I think, you know, in the sort of the pre-modern era, the crops were much more diverse and the diet was as well, although people as a whole were probably eating more grains just because they were such an immense source of calories. But in the modern era, you know, we now have a very stable supply, at least in the, you know, our country, we have a stable supply of a pretty uniform type of wheat. And that wheat is highly refined for the most part. You know, although whole grains are coming back, you know, white flour is still prevalent. And, you know, so we take out a lot of the nutritional elements of the grain, and we're eating this, you know, more uniform food. And, you know, does it lead to gluten intolerance issues? As I say, that's what the question researchers are now asking. But, you know, it's conjecture, but it's you know, perhaps that's the case.
My guest is Samuel Fromarts. His book is In Search of the Perfect Loaf, A Home Baker's Odyssey. I didn't think reading a book about bread that I would feel emotional and that I would have tears come to my eyes, but gall darn it, I was reading your book and that happened to me. It was the spot where you talk about how you had made the transition in your mind somehow from being a writer to being a baker, and this involved Alice Waters.
Yeah, it was. This goes back to the baguette story, which was really, it was kind of an uncanny series of coincidences, you know, that arose out of a situation where my work had evaporated. You know, as I said, I had gone to Paris to learn how to make a baguette and translate those lessons to the home kitchen. A food writer in Washington, D.C., tried my loaves and thought they were so extraordinary that he put them up in a blind tasting against professional bakers in Washington, and my loaves won this blind tasting contest, which was pretty extraordinary. But the next thing that happened is I was at the gym one day and I get a call on my phone, and I didn't take it. I just checked the message, and there's a message from Alice Waters' office. I thought it was a prank call from a friend of mine, but I called back the number, and sure enough, it's her office, and she and her assistant says, wonders if I can make bread for a charity dinner she's having at Bob Woodward's house. Because they heard I made the best baguette in Washington. So I had to, you know, I said, well, you know, I'm only a home baker. They said, we know. And I said, you know, the most I've ever baked for is a Thanksgiving dinner of, you know, about 20 people. And I said, how many people do you have in mind? And they said, well, about 40. So I said, let me call you back. And I thought about it. and then did it. But here's the funny thing, as you mentioned about that story, is I had interviewed Alice Waters before, and she never had remembered me. But when I met her that evening and delivered the breads, she was quite gracious. And after that moment, she never forgot who I was. And actually, subsequently, every year that she's done this charity event in Washington, she's asked me to bake bread. So if I'm in town, I do bake.
And there were people who were incredulous because you said, I bake these loaves at home. And they're like, what?
Yeah, the first time I delivered the bread, her executive chef, Jean-Pierre Moulet, who's a famous chef in his own right, he was in Bob Woodward's beautiful the kitchen of their beautiful house, and I walked in with the bread, and I opened up the loaves, and he said, "Oh, these are quite nice," and I said, "Yeah, well, you know, I'm just a home baker," and he said, "Yes. But you did not bake these at home." You know, he's French. And I replied, "Oh, yes, I did." It was quite a funny moment.
Wow.
But they really enjoyed the loaves. So that was kind of great.
Near the end of the book, we have the chapter where you go to Berlin, and you alluded to this earlier. The main reason you went there because you wanted to check out the rye bread. And Berlin is known for rye bread. And this reminded me of something that I hadn't thought about in many years. My father's parents were from Lithuania, and they came to this country at the end of the 19th century, lived in Chicago for 50, 60 years, never bothered to learn English. And at Christmas every year, they would send us a box, and it would have these great big loaves of rye bread that they were buying from some bakery in Chicago back in the 1960s. And I had never had anything like that in my life. We were used to eating white bread at home. I had no clue what this stuff was, but I just loved it. And I can't imagine that this bread probably even exists anymore.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I grew up with those immigrant bakers or sons of immigrants in New York City eating that sort of bread. All those bakeries have disappeared. But the really interesting thing is you have a very recent wave of artisan bread makers, mostly pretty young people, maybe too, you know, trying this path because they couldn't get jobs in the recession.
Mm-hmm.
And they're baking a lot of wonderful breads, some of which are in this Eastern European style of Swedish or Nordic ryes or Danish ryes or you know, Eastern European rye breads. And rye was the prevalent grain in those areas because it's a very hardy plant, and it grows well in the cold north. And so that became the mainstay of bread and of the diet. And I love those breads. I actually prefer whole grain rye or rye mixed with whole wheat to whole wheat, 100% whole wheat loaf itself. It's not among my favorite loaves. And I think now with all the emphasis on whole grains, people, you know, their first impulse is to try a whole wheat, and rye are just not that popular. But believe me, and as your experience shows, I mean, rye has really this terrific taste,
mm-hmm.
Especially the whole grain rye. So if you can find it, I would get it. And I would guess in places like Chicago, you know, there probably still are some remaining, you know, Eastern European bakeries that bake those kinds of loaves.
These loaves were almost black.
Yeah. That's as they should be when they're properly dark and they create all of these flavor compounds in the crust. It's not burnt, you know,
mm-hmm.
it's just a very deep caramelized flavor that when you combine it with the interior crumb, it just, you know, makes this magnificent combination of taste.
Samuel Fromartz joins us. His book is In Search of the Perfect Loaf, A Home Baker's Odyssey. And I don't want to neglect to mention that there are some recipes in this book. So for listeners who are interested in trying out some of these baking techniques and some of these loaves, there are some in here. Do you want to talk about any of those?
Yeah, I mean, I use a recipe at the end of each chapter to kind of elaborate on the point I'm trying to make in the chapter. So at the end of the Berlin chapter, for example, I have a recipe on making a rye bread. And I have recipes on how to begin a sourdough starter and make a sourdough kind of French country loaf. But I also have an extended bibliographic essay in the back of the book where I recommend a lot of other baking books, because I kind of make the point that my book is not a recipe book. There's so many great recipe books out there that I didn't feel we needed another one. I felt what we needed was a book that really explained where we came from and how to work with it. Because ultimately, I think the recipe is about 10 to 20% of your success, and the other, you know, 80 to 90% really comes from techniques of understanding dough. And that's what I try to convey through these stories of bakers, because they're following recipes, but it's really the techniques and the craft of it, and much of it which comes through handwork, you know, that produces success. And so you have to learn. Your hands, in a sense, have to learn, and they have to learn enough to tell your mind what to do, which is a very unusual state of affairs, I think, you know, these days, where everything sort of, all of our learning, all of our tasks sort of, you know, come from our mind. And in this case, I really felt like my hands were sort of leading the way, which is an interesting process.
Well, it really piqued my interest reading about sourdough starters and all the different ways that you have created those and how to make one. I might actually try to do that myself sometime. It's all here in the book, In Search of the Perfect Loaf, A Home Baker's Odyssey. Samuel Fromarts has been our guest. And when you get to the end, you can learn how Sam made a pizza on the beach. This is a really fun book. Thank you so much for your time today.
Well, thank you for having me. It was great talking with you.
You've been listening to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and once again, the book is In Search of the Perfect Loaf, A Home Baker's Odyssey. Samuel Fromarts wrote it. Thanks for listening. If you are a regular Book Nook listener, you're probably accustomed to listening to the program on Fridays in the afternoon at 1:30 or on Sunday mornings at 11. We do have some schedule changes coming up. From now on, you'll be able to hear the program on Saturday morning at 7 o'clock, and it will be a full hour of the Book Nook. And then we'll continue on Sundays with our 30-minute Book Nook slot at the same time that you're accustomed to at 11 o'clock. That's the Book Nook at new times in October, and we hope that you'll put that on your schedule. You can check out all the new programming and schedule changes at the WYSO website. Just go to wyso.org, and you can check out the new lineup. And thanks for listening to the Book Nook and supporting the program. The Book Nook is recorded at Soundspace in Yellow Springs and engineered by Chris Hertzler.